Hi, welcome back. It's no secret that things have gotten pretty dire on tech sales floors, and moving forward is going to take some uncomfortable conversations. But sitting in that discomfort together with curiosity rather than resistance is what leads to the deepest connections and trust. And for that reason, we begin season four with the great Nikki Ivey. Nikki has had a long and illustrious career in tech as a seller, sales leader, purveyor of inspiration, and currently helping women business leaders land corporate clients. She's also got a super engaged LinkedIn following, and I am excited to share her brilliance today. Buckle up, babies. This one is as real as it gets. We dive headfirst into questions like, does the existential crisis ever end? Is there hope for tech sales? What to do with the loss of perceived relevance as we age out of sales? And ultimately, finding purpose and power in the work that you do. I live for conversations like this, and it is an honor to bring them to the forefront. Thank you, listener, for coming along for the ride. It's time to talk about all the uncomfortable conversations that accompany a life in sales so you can sell less and win more. I'm Amy Rahubchek, and you're listening to Revenue Real. Nikki Ivey, welcome to Revenue Real, my friend. How are you today?
I am so excited. I'm in a great mood. I'm in Florida, for those that don't know, just outside Jacksonville, and we got sunshine. I can go to the pool again. So it can be really difficult to steal my sunshine.
So I'm on the Jersey Shore, and I live right by a state park that is a beach, and I'm right there with you. Like, no one's stealing my thunder today. And so I'm excited to put our sunshine and thunders together. Okay, for the listeners, who are you and what do you do every day?
I'm Nikki Ivey. I've been in sales for about 15 years, tech sales the last 10. And what I do every day is I help women entrepreneurs. I coach women entrepreneurs to close corporate deals. And I do that by teaching them a framework for how to position and market and ultimately present and propose their solutions in a very different way than a lot of entrepreneurs are used to doing. It's easy to assume, right? I'm a business owner. Of course, I know business. I can make things happen. But since we also know that nothing happens until somebody sells something, there is that gap, right? Anybody, if you are a senior sales leader and you've ever worked with a founder CEO, then you know what I'm talking about, right? They come in, they want the sales thing, and all the information they're getting is talking about that. Anyway, I guess we'll get to this in the conversation. But you asked me, and I talk about this a lot, you asked me like to talk about who I am, and I gave you my resume. Mm-hmm. What?
Yeah. Well, if I were a betting woman, I would put money on the fact that we were raised in the United States of America, where people are valued based on their productivity and contribution to capitalism. Like, that may have something to do with it, Nikki. Like, call me crazy, but...
But I know. But it's like these sales existential crises that we try to avoid all the time, right? Who am I? Am I this number or am I this person?
And do I, as a person, still have value if that number isn't where it needs to be this quarter?
Right. Or with the rise of community and everybody talking about your networks, am I still that if I don't work at that place anymore? Imagine you have a company that everybody's trying to prospect and you're in a position that you're the one saying yes or no about the sales tools. Everybody wants to be your friend because you're that person. They want you to be in their network. You are Nikki from X tech company, right? Mm-hmm. You want to know. But then if I don't work there anymore, I'm getting fewer messages. Nobody really cares about me anymore. You can find that way that the relationships weren't what you thought they were. They end up being, sadly, in a lot of cases, more self-serving. And so, again, although we haven't gotten to that conversation, I'm interested to see when and in what way we confront this as a profession. Like, are we ever going to cut the SHIT and say that when we're talking about networks, or when we're talking about relationships, there are some folks that are talking about actual meaningful relationships that would follow each other from one organization or job function or decision maker title to the next. But I would say that the vast majority are likely transactional and just the two folks involved, other folks involved, each accepted it's transactional. And so we'll see. But are we going to really be about community and network, or are we going to continue to treat it like a means to an end?
two things came to mind as you were speaking that. One, I'm looking down at my notes as I was preparing for this conversation and covering like the current state of tech sales. And literally the only thing I wrote underneath it is there hope? ? But also like, as you were talking about the transactional relationship, yeah, it's egregious in our profession for sure. But I also like think about how transactional the relationships have become around dating. Using dating apps, which is, I also think, a function of tech. Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to this. Is there hope? I've lost count how many conversations I've had in the past 3 weeks alone, 3 weeks, where people are talking about, I'm over tech sales. Mm-hmm. I'm over it. And for various reasons, it's actually pretty wild. Some of those reasons include just simply do not value the human beings on the team that we're selling to. Number one. Number two, the business model. When you're in a startup, a high growth startup that is VC funded, you're most likely aiming for an exit of some kind. Mm-hmm. Which is, it perpetuates that transactional aspect. Right. Like those relationships don't necessarily mean something. We want the logo acquisition. That's all that matters. Even if revenue is a lot easier by servicing our clients and expanding that relationship. And so you're really truly up against the business model. And then I would take AI as a third example. It's not going to be very difficult to use some large language model to program a conversation bot mm-hmm. to have a meaningful conversation with the prospect about their business problem or outcomes that they're looking for. And if there is a sector that is very excited about that prospect, it is tech. And so even like the future trajectory, with that, I'm going to pause. What are you hearing? What are your thoughts? And is there hope, Nikki?
I think there has to be, just as there has to be in the micro with an individual sales career or even an individual sales role, right? My success, I have found, has been in direct correlation to the level of purpose I felt in doing the job.
Such a great point.
And I came into the industry at a time when we had just got our shiny new spam cannons. and I was, my first job was it was 100 cold call a day minimum, one call close pressure situation. So again, it's very easy to get so caught up in this that you lose the element of purpose. And if you lose the element of purpose, it's difficult to be successful. And when you're unsuccessful, it's difficult to be hopeful. So to a large extent, what we're talking about is like what people are afraid of and what I think it's going to take for us to get to this hopeful place. We talk about this in the 12% program at Stimulus, my company. It's the concept of massive imperfect action, and it is the scariest thing for most people, especially when it comes to the culture of an industry or of a profession. What if I get it wrong? And we lose sight of the fact that the action does not need to be perfect. And so as a woman living at the intersection of race and gender, that is what I would need to see. I would need to see people overcome their fear of getting it wrong in order for me to feel more hopeful. Because the hope I'm talking about right now, it's in here, it's in my heart, but I do intellectually have a high level of cynicism about what will happen in the short term, whereas I'm hopeful about what can happen in the long term. Did I answer your question, you even?
Yeah, it did. And I have the chills. Gosh, what I wrote down. What does it take back to get back to hopeful, massive, imperfect action? Oh, and visually seeing people overcome the fear of getting it wrong. Hi, my name is Amy. I'm a recovering perfectionist. I've been sober for all of 5 hours. So that one definitely, that hits home. So, you know, the theme of the show obviously is uncomfortable conversations. One of, I think, the most important, often unspoken type of uncomfortable conversations are the ones that we have with ourselves. And one of my favorite things about watching and observing your journey and through our interactions and your posts on LinkedIn is whether it's, gosh, and this is just in a couple of past weeks alone, whose peace are you keeping? Jeez Louise, like that one went right to the soul. How to create a favorite or follows a best of post, the video about like incorporating Black humans into your like spectacular. Racism is not Beetlejuice. And so like, I have to ask you, what is your take on uncomfortable conversations? How are you able to have so many of them, obviously with yourself, but also to bring that into the public sector? Like,
Yeah, I mean, it comes from just being fed up. It comes from seeking peace and wondering why. That has always been so difficult for me as a human being, as a Black person, and as a woman. And so I always go back and reference. We have done things that seemed impossible with respect to civil rights, with respect to progress. Now, those things, a lot of those things happened or began in the 60s. And so what I try to think about is, where did they get that drive from, right? What caused them to take on this mission? And it is this phrase that we hear in protests all the time, no justice, no peace. Wow. That's why I don't have peace. Because how can I in the absence of justice? So in seeking peace, I had to seek justice. And sometimes justice is a political thing. Sometimes justice is a literal thing. But so it is social justice. It is fairness in how I am treated and regarded. And how people who walk a similar walk as I do based on background are treated and regarded. So it isn't some moral superiority. It isn't some, you know, level of intellectual enlightenment that I got to at some point. It was just flat out, I need my peace. Just like what you talked about, that post that I shared yesterday, whose peace am I keeping? Once I figured out, right, that I don't have peace because I don't have justice, the people whose peace I was keeping was the people who were denying me justice in these different content. And so I do have to knock it over. I do have to disrupt it. Especially if I believe in what it is that I'm trying to get to, this vision, which you've probably heard me say a lot of the time, wherever it is we're trying to get to, I'd like us to get there together. If I really believe that, and I really believe that my voice can impact that, then the question is, it's very simple, right? If I want those things and I don't see anybody else around doing them or making, in this particular industry that is, right? I wasn't hearing people having that conversation, then it's an imperative. It just is. And it's not fair that folks who live at this intersection have for so long been the keepers of that peace, been the ones denied that justice. But we seek it. Everything that you see that looks like a protest, that looks like a riot, are people seeking peace in here that they cannot have ever in the absence of justice anyway. So that is where it came from. And beyond that, as far as how I express it and why I express it that way, is I understand that when I am trying to learn something, genuinely want to learn, then being condescended to, even if I was wrong, makes it difficult for me to make progress. So I am, I'm not careful not to offend, but I am careful not to insult. That was a huge part of the journey. Because, I mean, if you're watching the world and politics like I'm watching, there's a few people I would like to cuss out, right? I would like to directly insult them. But you can't demonize people who you also want to help. You can't demonize people who you also want to be part of the solution eventually. So it is a very thin line to walk, that line between not insulting people and not offending people. And so that tone of grace that I try to approach these conversations is intentional, right? I get people in my inbox like, you better than me, girl, because I would have said X, Y, Z. And I'm like, well, I thought I really shredded this person, but
apparently, well, like the grace is coming through. So thank goodness for that. When you talked about condescension, I was laughing to myself, remembering when I was first learning about triggers, the concept of a trigger and what my own triggers were, right? Just a function of learning how to be present, get in touch with how you're feeling, all the things. Condescension was the first trigger that I identified for myself many years ago. And so I'd feel you on that one. It's inspiring, Nikki. You're inspiring. And I read somewhere that that is one of your gifts. And so how did you come to realize that inspiration was one of your gifts?
It was more like coming to accept it. It's something that I had always felt about myself. Like since the time I was very small, I would pay attention to how people reacted when I spoke and when other people spoke. And the ones who made me feel something are the ones that I patterned my communication style after in a very intentional way before I knew what I was doing still, right? So then that just became a matter of, you know, practicing reinforcement. And I studied journalism. I did a lot of theater in high school. And I love music. Music informs a lot of my communication style because it moves people. It inspires people. So all of those things together from a technical standpoint are where that comes from. Again, there wasn't this realization, but the acceptance part was accepting that that is valuable, really, truly valuable. Because in a sales career, what we value is so concrete. If I know that my ability to inspire is a significant differentiator as a sales leader, how can I prove that to you on paper next to someone who, let's say all things are equal, but this person edges out in a couple of number categories? We treat these things and ourselves as salespeople as so, again, transactional and as so, lack of a better phrase, right? So black and white that I had started to believe, sure, you are these things. You are inspirational. You can motivate people and help them see things in themselves. But what's that worth if you missed quota? And so like I put this pressure on myself, like, Nikki, you don't want to be a mascot. And if you're having success, it's because they like you and that's not worth anything. If you're being hired, it's because you tell good stories and that's not really worth anything. So all of these things that probably as responses to earlier trauma made it really difficult for me to see, not only is it valuable, but like I said, it is a differentiator. And that came with content. That came with how people responded to the things that I was saying and the rooms that that got me in. And I just at a certain point had to be real with myself, right? Like, Nikki, if it's not valuable, why are you in this room with all of these people who have degrees that you don't, went to Ivy League schools that you didn't? You know what I'm saying? Three, four exits under their name that you don't have. There must be something. And you know what? They invited you to this room, so they see it. What are you doing? What are you doing? And it wasn't until I realized that I was hurting other people, right? Like I said, as a trauma response, I tend to be okay hurting myself, I know. But because I know I'll recover, I guess. I don't know. We'll unpack that another time. But if I realize that or get the impression that something I am doing could have a detrimental effect on folks coming up, that's what triggers the examination of my behavior. So if 20 years ago, Nikki is entering the sales profession and she has the ability to inspire, the way I phrase it, a lot of the time I'm a galvanizing force on a sales floor, right? So there's this other young lady, let's say she's coming up and she too is a galvanizing force on a sales floor. People around her succeed in part, in no small part, because of what she brings, how she encourages folks. And then she sees somebody like me who is very visible, downplaying, not leaning in to this ability, this God-given gift to inspire people. It's something that I just had to step into for that reason. And it's something I still have to come back to and remind myself of because I do still work in sales. I do still work in business. And I understand, like, I'm a businesswoman. I do understand that numbers matter and that is the bottom line is literally the bottom line. But I think a lot of teams, say, even within, say, a SaaS startup could benefit from a little bit more inspiration, right? So if you think about the organizations you've worked at, right? I like to pick on startups. So if you think about those and you think about who the most inspirational leaders in the building tend to be, the ones casting the vision, it's the senior sales leader. It's the VP of sales who is coming in there and getting people fired up behind this idea. But what are the folks in products doing? What are the engineers doing? Are their leaders having it encouraged in them to be those inspirational visionaries? Do you know what I mean? So across the organization, there are all of these opportunities for us to tap into the power of being inspired, tap into the power of finding purpose in the work that you do. So I don't even remember why I was telling you any of that. Oh,
No. I asked about how you came to realize that you were inspirational. And you said it wasn't about realizing, it was about acceptance. And I followed every damn word. And frankly, I can't wait to go back and work on the conversation because it was spectacular.
69% of reps miss quota. The average win rate hovers at 18%. 70% of reps struggle with mental health, and sales bosses have no choice but to lay off most of their team. That is before they themselves are replaced every 18 months. And these numbers are only getting worse. Why? Shockingly, I have some thoughts. For starters, the CRM data we're using to diagnose why deals did not close is garbage. Want to know the real reason buyers report not moving forward? It's their buying experience. They're over the salesy, friends. However, the go-to solution that is all the rage is to implement a methodology like Medic or MedPick. The problem is that this framework is all about the seller getting what they need out of the interaction rather than the buyer. buyers buy when they feel understood, friends. What would the impact be if your entire team started winning just 10% more of the deals that they touch? Help your team shift their focus back to the buyer, and you'd be shocked how quickly those deals start rolling in. For more on how this is done, call me. Okay, so I want to go back to what you were saying before we started recording with this concept of intersectional feminism and specifically how age plays into this. And listeners, just so everyone knows, Nikki and I are in the same generation. And so as Nikki was bringing this up, I asked ahead of time, what's the uncomfortable conversation on your mind right now? And I was pretty floored. I wasn't the only one thinking about this. And so would you expand on this,
my friend? I do a lot of content, and I get invited sometimes to the places where the cool kids are, right? And the places where the cool kids these days, because of how the profession of sales is changing, tend to be fresh-faced young folk coming in here trying to make their way. And I am such a champion of those people. I'm so excited for this next generation of sellers that is going to have this broad set of ways that we do sales at their fingertips. And I'm so glad about that. But I have to think about what that means for how I show up, more specifically what that means for how people perceive the way I show up. And sales being an appearance conscious profession, that's what caused me to start thinking about, okay, how much pressure am I putting on myself to show up always with makeup on camera? How much is that increasing as I age? Right? How much is thinking more deeply about where I go, how I dress, who's going to be there, and all of these things? Not for me, not coming from this vanity point of view, but understanding the perceptions that already exist in the world about women and how, in so many ways, women are discarded, right? So, as a woman over 40, I started to think on sales floors, did I ever see a salesperson that was over 40? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And if they were and they were a woman, how were they treated? Mm-hmm. As it differs from, like, I'm, as a woman over 40, I'm conscious of difference in how I'm treated now and how I was treated when I was younger. So again, these aren't things that we should ignore, but they are uncomfortable. Can I say the F word?
Yes.
They're uncomfortable as fuck. Mm-hmm. And because even right now you can hear I am uncomfortable talking about it because I'm so conscious of, well, if you say that, then you'll sound like a hater, you know?
So, yeah. Yeah. Well, let me add my voice to it then. I was having a conversation with a mentor of mine, a badass woman sales leader, highly accomplished, older. This was like last year, and we were talking about, I was just about to turn 40. And I said that I was just being very intentional with my decisions about where to work next, with the mindset that I've got probably another 10 years of being perceived as relevant. Uh-huh. And she stopped in her tracks and she looked at me and she's like, Amy, that you are thinking about this and are like fearing that, like, that just fucking broke my heart. But at the same time, to your point, it's the reality of the situation.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you used the word relevant. I was struggling to find what I was looking for, right? So it's not that that is the worry. It isn't, am I not going to be cute anymore? Will people not think I'm pretty? But it is me understanding what people not thinking I'm pretty means for how relevant they think that I am. And if being relevant and making people aware of you and what you do is part of how you make money, it is a very reasonable thing to start to confront. And I don't know the answer. I really don't.
It starts by talking about it, number one. And number two, like, back to the hard conversations you have with yourself. I'm not sure if you're following Phil Putnam. He's a great friend of mine. He started this. It was a book club. And we read this book on, like, motherhood. It's never a book I would have picked up. And it got me thinking about when I was the problem as a young woman. Mm-hmm. And when did I make the older women around me feel less relevant? When did I show up with that? And I posed that question to this group and it caught, like, the person, whoever was sharing, it wasn't even a dig at them, but it was so obvious in the banter that we were looking at this older woman and all the things, like, bitchy, all the things that are said. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so it's two things. It's having the conversations and it's challenging ourselves. When was I the problem so that I can understand it, not do it again, and also educate those around me.
But it's also informed my decision to not pursue another job and really figure it the fuck out with the business as I'm trying to sell business services to companies, because I need a path where my relevance is not dictated by the people around me.
Yes.
And so that's what I'm going to fucking figure out.
Yes. You remind me of a lot of the women that I coach. So many of the women in our program.
Which is a perfect transition.
Are leaving corporate situations and healing from corporate trauma for the reasons that you talk about. When they come into the program, these are the things that they're saying. The other theme among those women, right? So there is the, what am I leaving? But the, what am I going to? Oh, they're just so beautiful. These businesses are all mission-driven. They're all about, how do I impact culture at an organization? How do I help this group deal with grief? How do I help this group retain more employees of color? So they're working on these big problems in the world that they had just been experiencing months before, right? Or a few years before on the other side of it. And so I hear you, and I'm right there with you, right? Finding success on your own terms is what I think becomes the imperative once you do age out of a sales career. It's pretty wild.
It is fucking wild, because it's like all the things that you've learned, all the value that you bring, like all being inspirational. Like I was told early on, I couldn't understand why I was being pulled into these like massive boardrooms with like multi-millionaires. But I was told that I had this ability to influence the room. And so when I think about a superpower like that you've built on for 20 years, and to still have the perception be not relevant, like it really is wild. Okay, but enough about that. I want to go back to this business and these frameworks. As a woman who's looking to build and market and sell services to companies, tell me about the work that you're doing right now. What is this framework that you speak of? And let's go from there.
So before we get into all of that, it starts with what pissed me off, right? What pisses me off is that less than 12% of women-owned businesses ever hit six figures in annual revenue. Less than 4% ever hit seven figures in annual revenue. So if that's happening in the entrepreneur space, and we're leaving the corporate space because that a lot of the time isn't conducive or welcoming either, then the only lever to pull is to empower these women, as many as possible. You know what I'm saying? As many as possible to just go in there and get it. So like we talked about, to take for granted that because I have general business acumen and because I have this mission, this business that I believe in, to take for granted that also means I know how to sell it, is obviously a mistake.
Say it as it so.
Well, we walk people through. We start at the beginning. How is your business positioned? It is easy for a lot of people to skip ahead. They know the offering. And they know why they want to offer it, but they don't understand how to quantify and qualify the value of that offer in a sales conversation. How to make sure within how you think about your positioning in the first place that you're on the right track. So for instance, as part of that positioning thought process, right, we are asking about, you know, what is the big picture problem you solve at the industry level? So you and I are sitting here talking, and let's say I sold outsourced sales outreach, right? Outsourced outbound activity. The business industry level problem that I solve, that they all know that it hurts, right? That I can just say and it will resonate, is I'm targeting these businesses that have overall teams of about 25 people, right? What I know that means, is that there is a founder CEO who was more than likely the one who was responsible for making sure that the outbound stuff gets done and running the business, right? You've been at a startup where somebody said to you, it's all hands on deck. We all wear many different hats. Mm-hmm. And then we've seen how that falls apart.
Yeah.
So that's something I would identify qualifying it, right, as this industry level problem, right? How do you, I ask it as a question, right? How do you make sure that you're constantly building outbound pipeline without it dominating the time that you need to be spending on other parts of the business? That's one question. The second question, when you're thinking about how your business is positioned, is what is this problem I've just qualified? What on average, through research, can I discern that it costs companies when they ignore it? So that's the quantifying the status quo. And it sounds very simple, But I see things a lot of the time, like because we're talking about, again, these mission-driven businesses, I see, again, folks come in so connected to that, that when I ask them what the actual problem is, again, they start to talk about their solution. Or when I'm not having any success when I reach out to people, we end up having to revisit, well, are you targeting the right businesses? And find things like, well, I was targeting this industry because that's what I love or where I have a lot of experience. Then I'm like, well, this industry isn't particularly vulnerable to the problem that you saw, right? Mm-hmm. And the personas you've been going after aren't typically responsible for solving the problem that you solve. So it usually triggers another look at the ideal customer profile. After that, then it just becomes a matter of storytelling and making sure that you are telling that story cohesively throughout the process. And so if I've started the conversation with that question, right, with the how do you make sure, right? And that is the pitch, by the way. I'm not going to come at you like, I saw. Let me not roast nobody. But anyway, that's the other piece that we help. I'm talking about women with, I mean, these are doctors I'm working with, attorneys and all of this. So like clearly they have well-developed communication skills. But again, it's a different skill.
Yeah. And so hard when you're so close to it. It's wild, Nikki, as somebody that has done this for years for so many other people in so many different industries or like with different target audiences. It is wildly difficult when it is your own stuff. You're just so close to it. All the emotional stuff is intertwined. All hypothetically speaking, of course. You got me thinking, though, about those numbers of less than 4% ever hit $1 million in business. To your point about reevaluating the ICP, one of the things that I have since identified are women owned small businesses. And my thing is buyer experience, right? Which when I was selling, I averaged a win rate of 75% for every opportunity I touch. With the boot camps, I teach how to connect. I teach how to get better at understanding through your sales cycle, which all then, but that said, you just shot a torpedo through my hypothesis because apparently these businesses don't exist. Women-owned businesses that have a sales floor.
So in our program, it's an accelerator, and there are these milestones. One of the milestones is hiring your first W-2 employee. So there are these three stages, and try not to give it away, but there are these three stages that we talk about as far as your journey as a business owner, right, a founder. And that is the validation stage, which is where most people are when they come to me. They're still figuring out this positioning. A lot of the time, they're trying to take their B2C offer, where they've been coaching individual women, and take that to corporate entities. And you have to confront, hey, do I want a lifestyle business? Which is fine. Do I want to feel like I'm making a difference? Because I get to do and work with the kinds of people that I want. Like, I want to work with women small business owners. Do I get to do that and make money at the same time? And for a lot of us, the answer is no. The answer is no, unless you're doing like a B2C play, right? And you're coaching those women individually. But if we're talking about at the B2B level, because if you think about the framework I just talked about, if we're talking about qualifying, quantifying the status quo for those businesses, it is going to be difficult to dig into that pain point for them financially because it doesn't show up the same. If I'm talking to the leader of a unicorn startup, he can tell me exactly how much missing quota cost them. He could tell me exactly how much turnover of the sales team cost him so that I can quantify the problem. But if I'm talking to a small business owner and I'm asking that same question, right, what does it cost you? Because a lot of the time they haven't closed a corporate client yet, the ones I work with, or they don't sell to these larger businesses, then it's going to be difficult for them to give you a number. So then you would have to talk about what you could help them gain, which we know in a sales scenario is less effective, talking about the future gain than the loss. So finding industries where it is concrete and direct, what that pain point is and what it's costing is something that has to be established. And again, it often means that you have to let go of your little baby. I've done it.
I'm already on two pivots at this point. So now I know what I'm doing this weekend, but also I'm really appreciative to not, I don't want to say waste the time, but spend time on something that doesn't have a viable path forward. And so I always appreciate knowing that.
So one last question, though, like, what's your piece of advice about uncomfortable conversations for somebody that's maybe wants to learn how to get maybe more comfortable with the uncomfortable? What would you say?
When you do this inventory, remove judgment of yourself from it. Because when you are trying to self-evaluate and judging yourself at the same time, that can cause you to leave certain doors closed that need exploration because you are uncomfortable with the truths behind them. But have you really done an exercise in self-evaluation if you haven't done that? So my most recent example of this is I've been thinking of writing a book and I came up with what I thought would be the first line. When you're in love, everything reminds you of being in love. When you're in sales, everything reminds you of being in sales. The everything in that case that inspired that thought was music, right? I was like, wow, because it's true. Mm-hmm. The uncomfortable conversation then is that love for sales unrequited? I had to ask myself that. That is the uncomfortable conversation that I had to have in order to transition into coaching and in order to get, again, that peace that I'm always seeking. So do not be afraid. Ask yourself that question. Is my love for XYZ, this industry that I want to sell into, this offering packaged the way that makes me feel good, is my love for those things being requited? And if it isn't, if the love is unrequited, do I stay? Would I recommend anybody else do that? If I wouldn't, should I treat myself that way, right? What would you tell your girlfriend? Your girlfriend says, I'm in this relationship. He don't love me. You would tell her to go.
Right.
But that is an uncomfortable conversation. So the skill, the hard skill or the thing to practice is definitely to remove that judgment, a dispassionate and objective evaluation of your behavior and your outcomes.
Well, listeners, you heard it here first. Objectivity, once again, reigns supreme. And that's a lifelong quest to figure out how to silence your own perceptions and judgments about the things around us, including ourselves. But with that, Nikki, this has been spectacular. You are spectacular. The work that you're doing right now is spectacular and inspiring. Your posts are inspiring. And I really appreciate you coming to chat on the show. Thank you for coming to hang out, truly.
Thank you. This was so much fun.
That's it for today. Thank you for listening, and thank you to my guest. Today's episode was planned, written, hosted, and produced by me, myself, and I, with moral support from my furry sidekick, Lola. Say hi. Or not. New episodes drop in every Thursday. I'll be experimenting with a new format this season. Think John Oliver, and I am giddy with excitement. Stay tuned. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show so you never miss a new episode. If you want to help other people find the show, please rate and review me. It really helps. If you want more information on how to create winning buying experiences, the factor most closely tied to improvements in quota attainment and win rates, you know how to find me. I'm Amy Rahufchek, and you've been listening to Revenue Real.